Usually when we watch a really fast-paced sport, there is this immediate expectation of chaos. I mean, it looks like a kind of demolition derby on ice.
Oh, for sure. It looks completely random to most
All
people.
right, you tune into a hockey game, and what hits you first is just the sheer velocity. You see 10 skaters flying around at 20 miles per hour, carbon fiber sticks slashing everywhere.
Yeah, bodies slamming violently into the boards.
Exactly. Everyone is frantically chasing this tiny piece of vulcanized rubber. To the casual observer, it is pure, unadulterated mayhem. It looks like the players are just reacting, driven entirely by adrenaline and instinct.
It is a comforting illusion, isn't it?
What do you mean by that?
But we inherently want to believe that sports at the highest level are driven by pure, unfiltered athleticism. Like, we
Yeah.
want to think the fastest, most aggressive player just hunts the puck, hits the opponent, and takes it.
Because that's what makes the highlight reels.
Right. But when you actually peel back the layers of offensive zone systems, that demolition derby reveals itself to be a finely tuned orchestra. What looks like a car crash is actually highly structured fluid geometry.
Fluid geometry disguised as a car crash. I love that.
Yeah.
And that actually brings us to the core of what we are doing today.
Yeah, we are looking at the hidden engine driving all of this organized chaos.
Exactly. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are getting into a master class on forechecking. And I want to be clear for you listening, this isn't about memorizing X's and O's on a dusty locker room whiteboard.
No, absolutely not.
It's about decoding the physical and mental battles happening on the ice in real time so that you can actually predict what's going to happen before the puck ever leaves a player's stick.
Because to truly understand the game, you have to understand the single biggest lever a coach can pull. It literally dictates the entire temperature of a match.
So let's start with a definition. What exactly is a forecheck?
By definition, forechecking is the pressure a team applies in the offensive zone when they do not have the puck.
So it is the absolute opposite of back checking.
Exactly. The millisecond a team loses possession in the attacking end, the forecheck begins. And the philosophy behind it all starts with recognizing that there are two very distinct ways to win this battle.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the two ways you can actually win a forecheck. Let's break those down because they represent entirely different philosophies. We have win one, which the source material calls the jackpot.
The jackpot, yes.
This is when a team forces a turnover and steals the puck back deep in the opponent's zone, meaning below the face-off hash marks, right down near the goal line.
Right.
Why is this the ultimate prize?
It really comes down to the natural flow of the players on the ice. Think about the mechanics of a breakout.
Okay.
When an opposing defenseman goes deep into their own corner to retrieve a dump puck, what do their forwards do?
They don't stay clustered around their own net.
Exactly. They naturally release up ice. They start skating away from their goalie, climbing toward the blue line, anticipating a breakout pass.
So they are essentially leaving the scene of the crime before the getaway car has even started.
That is a perfect way to put it. So if you're forechecking unit can ambush that defenseman in the corner and force a turnover right then and there, you have just instantly bypassed all three of their forwards.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the geography of the rink is entirely in your favor now. You have the puck 20 feet from the net in a high-danger scoring area.
And there might be only one panicked, flat-footed defenseman standing between your forward and the goaltender.
It's a sudden death scenario. It is
Yeah.
the absolute best outcome you can hope for.
But you can't always get the jackpot. Which brings us to win two, the quiet win.
Right, the quiet win. And honestly, this is arguably more important over the course of an 82-game season.
Really? Why is that?
Because in win two, your forecheck might never actually touch the puck deep in the offensive zone.
Wait, you win without touching the puck.
Yes. Instead of stealing it, your structure takes away all of the opponent's good passing lanes.
Yeah.
You force that retreating defenseman to look up, see a wall of opposing jerseys, and panic.
Ah, so they make a mistake.
They make a rushed, bad exit, usually blind chip off the glass or a forced rim around the boards. And then you intercept that panicked exit in the neutral zone, basically the middle of the ice.
Which feels, I don't know, less spectacular than stripping the puck right in front of the net. But there's a massive hidden benefit there.
You get
Huge.
huge benefit.
When you intercept a puck in the neutral zone, your team is generally already moving forward with momentum.
In the modern speed-driven game is often way more valuable than a static turnover in a crowded corner where everyone is just fighting for inches.
I see.
When you intercept a bad pass in the neutral zone, you instantly transition from defense to offense against an opponent who is caught skating in the wrong direction.
We actually have some fascinating statistical reality to back up just how vital this pressure is. The source material highlights Alex Novette's analysis of Corey Schnadger's hand-tracked microdata.
Oh yeah, this data is incredible.
It really is. When a team applies pressure to the puck carrier at the exact moment they're trying to exit the zone, the overall success of the forecheck skyrockets. Huh. And by success, we mean preventing the opponent from successfully entering your defensive zone.
Right.
It jumps from 45.7% to 78.1%.
It is a staggering jump. And, I mean, we need to be analytically responsible here, because measuring a deep corner turnover versus a neutral zone stop involves slightly different denominators.
Sure, the contexts are slightly different.
But the sheer impact of applying physical pressure is undeniable. Look at the failure rates.
Yeah.
When you pressure that exit point, the opponent's failed exits jump from 10% to 41%.
That is massive.
And clean carryouts, where the opposing player smoothly skates the puck out with control, those collapse from 19% down to a minuscule 4%.
You essentially delete their ability to skate the puck out of their own end. You force them to either dump it, ice it, or turn it over.
Exactly.
But here is where I want to push back a bit, or at least challenge the premise.
Go for it.
If win one, stealing the puck 20 feet from the net, is the absolute jackpot, and we know that applying pressure mathematically destroys the opponent's ability to cleanly exit, why wouldn't a team just max out the pressure all the time?
That is the big question.
Right. Like, is passive forechecking just lazy? If passive systems concede the deep retrieval, aren't you just handing the puck to an elite passer, say a Cale Makar or a Quinn Hughes, and letting them survey the ice uncontested? How is building a passive wall better than denying them the puck in the first place?
That is the central tension of the sport right there. And it brings us to the fundamental concept of the pressure and risk dial.
The pressure and risk dial. Okay, explain that.
You have to think of forechecking as a literal dial on an amplifier. Every single player you send deep into the offensive zone to hunt that puck is one fewer player protecting your own goaltender.
It's just simple arithmetic. You only have 5 skaters.
Right. If you send one forward deep to pressure, you have 4 players back to defend. That is incredibly safe. The opponent will likely break out, but they won't score.
Okay, that makes sense.
But if you crank the dial up and send 2 forwards deep into the corner, you win vastly more pucks. You increase your chances of hitting the jackpot.
The win one.
Yes. However, if those 2 forwards get beaten by 1 good pass, you suddenly have 3 opposing players rushing up the ice against only 3 of your defenders.
Ah, so the risk scales with the pressure.
Exactly. And if you max the dial out completely, sending 3 forwards deep plus a defenseman stepping up to pinch, you will terrorize the opponent. But the one time it fails, you hand them an uncontested full ice breakaway.
So to answer my own pushback, letting a guy like Cale Makar survey the ice is dangerous, sure.
Very dangerous.
But missing a high-speed check on Cale Makar and leaving him with a 3-on-2 odd-man rush going the other way is catastrophic.
Exactly. Passive systems are absolutely not lazy hockey. They are highly disciplined exercises in risk management.
That is a great way to frame it.
A coach adjusts the pressure dial based on variables. What is the score? How much time is left on the clock? Are my players at the start of their shift, or have they been on the ice for 60 seconds and are physically exhausted?
Okay, so let's pause and lock this in for you listening. What should we remember here from this first part?
The absolute core mental model is that pressure and risk are intrinsically linked. They are the exact same dial. You cannot increase your chances of stealing the puck without simultaneously increasing your risk of giving up a breakaway.
Okay, that frames the philosophy perfectly. But if we are turning this dial up and down, who actually goes in to apply this pressure?
Right, the actual people on the ice.
Let's talk about the geometry and the people executing it. F1, F2, F3, F1, F2, F3.
This is where we need to completely dismantle the most common misconception among casual fans.
Let's do it.
When we talk about F1, F2, and F3 in a forecheck, we are absolutely not talking about positions. We are not talking about the center, the left wing, and the right wing.
So F1 is not always the center.
Never assume that.
Yeah.
F1... F2 and F3 are dynamic roles,
yeah,
and they are dictated by one thing and one thing only, order of arrival.
Order of arrival. Whichever forward gets to the puck first is F1.
Period. If the puck gets dumped into the deep right corner, and your left winger happens to be the closest player because of a weird bounce or a previous play, your left winger is F1.
So they don't stop and reorganize.
No. They do not wait for the right winger to skate all the way across the 85-foot width of the ice
right,
to take their assigned side. The center doesn't take over just because they usually play low. Whoever's first is F1.
And then F2?
The second forward to arrive becomes F2. The third forward on the scene becomes F3. And F3's job is almost universally to stay high in the zone and act as the safety net.
I love this. It's S like the hockey equivalent of calling shotgun when you run to a car.
Yes.
It has nothing to do with assigned seating. It is entirely about who gets to the door first.
That is a phenomenal analogy.
Yeah.
And understanding that roles are based on arrival time unlocks this huge concept of dynamic rotation. Because hockey isn't static.
Right. Things change in half a second.
Exactly. Let's say F1 attacks the puck carrier in the corner. But the opposing defenseman is incredibly skilled and manages to snap a crisp cross-ice pass, a D-to-D pass, to their defensive partner on the completely opposite side of the rink.
Okay, so F1 has just been beaten.
Yes. The puck is now 60 feet away from them.
So what does F1 do? Because human instinct says you turn around, put your head down, and sprint as fast as you can to go hunt the puck again.
And if you do that at the professional level, you will destroy your team's defensive shape and be physically exhausted in about 20 seconds.
Really? Just from chasing?
Yes. If F1 turns and chases that cross-ice pass, they're trying to do the job of three different players. Instead, the moment that cross-ice pass is made, the roles instantly, seamlessly rotate.
How does that communication actually happen? Because they are moving at high speed, the crowd is screaming, they can't exactly have a polite conversation about who takes over.
No, they definitely can't hear each other well. It relies heavily on peripheral vision and spatial awareness, stuff that is drilled into them through thousands of hours of practice.
Okay.
The forward, who was acting as F2 or F3,
mm-hmm.
who is now physically closest to the new puck carrier on the far side of the ice, instantly realizes their proximity. They become the new F1 and immediately attack.
And the old F1?
The old F1, who is now stranded on the wrong side of the ice, does not chase. They drop back into the high central F3 support role.
No, that's brilliant. So by accepting the fact that you got beaten, you actually get a micro rest built into the system.
Exactly.
You drop into the high slot, catch your breath for 3 seconds, survey the ice, and act as the safety valve while your teammate takes over the exhausting high pressure role.
It is a breathing, rotating organism. The geometric shape of the forecheck remains constant, but the humans occupying the points of that shape constantly trade places.
That makes so much sense. But let's zoom in on the specific physical action of F1, because getting there first is only half the battle. What you do when you arrive dictates everything.
It really does. The foundation of F1's job is a highly technical skill called angling. And the golden rule of angling is very counterintuitive. You not skate at the puck?
Wait.
You skate at the space you want to deny.
Unpack the physics of that for me. If I am F1 and I want the puck, why wouldn't I skate directly at the guy holding it?
Think about the geometry. If you skate directly at a puck carrier in a perfectly straight line, you're committing all of your momentum to a single static point in space.
Right.
You are like a missile locked onto a coordinate.
Mm-hmm.
Any competent hockey player will wait until you're a few feet away, simply sidestep you, and use your own unalterable momentum against you.
So I just fly right past them.
You fly right past them, and now you are 40 feet beyond the play.
Okay, so how do I skate at space without just getting blown by?
Your approach must be curved. As you skate into the offensive zone, you use your outside edges to carve a rounded path, physically inserting your body between the puck carrier and the center of the ice.
Ah, okay.
You are essentially using your physical mass to build a wall that forces them to skate toward the boards.
Because the boards are an immovable object, they act as an extra defender. By taking away the middle of the ice, you drastically reduce the angles they have to pass the puck.
Precisely. You dictate their path. Mm-hmm. You force them into a claustrophobic alleyway. And as you execute this curved approach, your stick positioning is critical.
What should the stick be doing?
Your stick must be extended out in front of you with the blade flat on the ice, actively occupying the passing lane back to their defensive partner.
So you aren't trying to poke the puck away from them?
Not initially. That simple stick placement eliminates their safest option without requiring you to make any physical contact whatsoever.
It's psychological pressure just as much as physical pressure. You are shrinking their world.
And you must arrive under control. The source material provides a fantastic litmus test for a forechecker here. As you close in on the opponent, ask yourself, could you stop and pivot backwards right now?
Stop and pivot backwards. Okay.
If the answer is no, if your momentum is carrying you forward so hard that stopping is physically impossible, you are going too fast. You have lost the ability to react.
Which really highlights the difference between hitting a player and eliminating their options. Because I think a lot of people assume a great forecheck means delivering a bone-crushing hit that rattles the glass.
Hitting is spectacular for the fans, but tactically, it is highly flawed.
Really? Why?
When you deliver a massive body check, you take two players completely out of the play, the opponent and yourself.
Oh, because you both stop moving.
Exactly. If the puck squirts loose from the collision, neither of you can retrieve it because you are tangled up together.
So a hit is just a one-for-one trade.
Yes. But containment, using a curved angle to trap them against the board so they have absolutely nowhere to go, that takes out only them.
Right, because you are still standing.
Exactly. They are pinned, their options are zero, but you are still upright, your stick is free, and you remain an active participant in the play.
Plus, we have to acknowledge that in the vast majority of hockey played around the world, adult recreational leagues, many women's leagues, and youth hockey up to a certain age, open ice hitting isn't even legal.
Which is exactly why angling is the universal language of defense. Both USA Hockey and Hockey Canada explicitly state in their rulebooks that angling, steering, and containment are perfectly legal in non-checking leagues.
As long as you don't throw a hip or shoulder.
Right, provided you don't extend an arm, a shoulder, or a hip to intentionally deliver a blow. You use your feet to carve the ice, you use your stick to block the lane, and you let the boards act as the final barrier.
That actually brings up a massive point regarding player safety. The source text is incredibly stern about the responsibilities of F1 when entering these high-speed corner battles.
It cannot be overstated. When a puck is gumped deep into the zone, the defending player is forced to skate back toward their own end.
Right.
To pick up the puck, they physically have to turn their back to the rest of the ice. They are facing the end boards. They cannot see what is coming behind them.
They are completely vulnerable.
Exactly. If you are F1, arriving at 20 miles per hour, the absolute onus of safety is 100% on you.
Yeah.
You must play the puck. You must take the available ice, or you must steer them. You must never finish a check into the back of a vulnerable player facing the boards.
Because the biomechanical consequences are just terrifying.
They're life-altering. Under the NHL and IIHF rulebooks, checking from behind is considered so dangerous that there isn't even a minor two-minute penalty for it in certain dangerous contexts.
Wait, the floor for the penalty is higher than a minor?
Yes. If the hit recklessly endangers a player who is unable to defend themselves, it is an automatic five-minute major and a game misconduct. You are ejected instantly.
Wow.
USA Hockey and Hockey Canada are similarly draconian about this. Think about the posture of a player digging a puck out of the corner. They are bent over. If they are hit from behind, they are propelled head first into the unforgiving dasher boards.
Yeah, that's incredibly dangerous.
If a player the chin is tucked toward their chest when they hit the boards, the natural curve of the cervical spine straightens out. USA Hockey medical literature notes that an impact in this posture can cause catastrophic spinal fractures even at walking speed.
It turns the spine into a straight column, taking the entire load of the impact. That is harrowing. It completely contextualizes why arriving under control and prioritizing angling over explosive hitting isn't just a tactical choice. It is a moral imperative in the sport.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's do a quick periodic review for the listener. What are the key takeaways from this section on geometry and roles?
You want to remember that F roles are entirely fluid and based on who arrives first. Angling, or space denial, is always superior to hitting because it keeps you in the play, and safety is paramount.
Perfect. So we understand the individual roles, we understand the fluid rotation, the mechanics of angling, and the critical safety parameters. Let's look at what happens when a coach decides to weaponize these roles.
Now we get into the systems.
Right. What happens when a team is trailing, the clock is ticking, and the coach cranks the pressure dial to maximum?
That takes us into the aggressive frameworks. And the absolute standard bearer here, a system taught from youth peewee hockey all the way to the Stanley Cup Finals, is the 2-1-2.
Okay, let's visualize the shape of the 2-1-2. In hockey systems, the numbers always count outward from the opponent's goal line back toward the neutral zone. So a 2-1-2 means two forwards pushed deep below the faceoff circles, one forward hovering high in the middle of the offensive zone, and two defensemen anchoring the blue line.
Let's break down how this engine fires. F1 goes in hard on that curved angle we discussed, forcing the opposing puck carrier toward the boards. But here's the secret to the 2-1-2. F2, the second forward arriving, does not look at the puck.
Oh, wow. That's incredibly difficult to process at speed. You are telling F2 to ignore the vulcanized rubber everyone is fighting for.
Completely ignore it. If F2 chases the puck, they end up right next to F1, creating a redundant pileup. You have two guys doing one job.
Right. So what do they do?
F2 reads the angle, F2 attacks the first passing option. If F1 forces the opposing defenseman to skate up the right wall, F2 instantly jumps the opposing right winger, who is standing on the boards waiting for the outlet pass.
So the trap is sprung, the puck carrier is under physical duress from F1, they instinctively look to their winger for a safety valve, and F2 is already there suffocating that winger.
It creates total panic. Meanwhile, F3 stays high in the middle of the ice around the top of the faceoff circles, acting as the safety net.
Doing what exactly?
Well, if F1 and F2 win the puck, F3 slides down into the high slot, wide open for a pass and a prime scoring opportunity. If the forecheck fails, F3 is in perfect position to backpedal and defend the counterattack.
The source outlines two specific variations of this 2-1-2, the spread and the stacked.
Yes. In the spread 2-1-2, F1 and F2 enter the zone on opposite sides of the ice. They are covering both corners, ensuring that no matter which way the opposing defenseman turns, pressure is arriving. It's balanced.
And the stacked?
The stacked variant is pure overload. In a stacked 2-1-2, F1 and F2 surge into the exact same strong side corner. F3 even shades over toward that side. You are entirely abandoning one half of the ice rink to put overwhelming numerical superiority in one small 50-square-foot area.
It's an all-in bet. You are telling the opponent, I am going to put so many bodies in this corner that you will physically not be able to move the puck out. When is a coach actually deploying this?
You use it when you are trailing late in the game. You use it against defensemen who have poor puck handling skills and crack under physical pressure. Or, fascinatingly, you use it immediately following an icing call.
Let's dive into the icing rule, because this is a perfect example of how a rulebook dictates strategy. Why is icing a trigger for a stacked 2-1-2?
Under NHL and IIHF rules, when a team ices the puck, meaning they shoot it from their half of the ice all the way down past the opponent's goal line without anyone touching it, play stops.
Right.
But crucially, the team that committed the icing is legally prohibited from changing their players on the ice.
Yeah.
And they cannot call a timeout.
So you have a group of five players who just sprinted for 45 seconds. Their lungs are burning. Their legs are filled with lactic acid. And now they're forced to line up for a defensive zone faceoff.
Exactly. They are physiologically compromised. As the attacking team, you send out your freshest line, the puck drops, you dump it into the corner, and you hit them with a stacked 2-1-2. You physically exhaust an already tired group of players. It is ruthless.
It's brilliant, though.
It is. Now, it is worth noting that USA hockey rules generally do allow line changes after an icing at the amateur levels. So that specific tactical mismatch doesn't exist in youth hockey. But at the pro level, it is a devastating weapon.
Okay, but every system has an Achilles heel. If a stacked 2-1-2 is so suffocating, how does an NHL defense ever break out of it?
The kryptonite of the 2-1-2 is a single, clean rim.
A rim being when the defending player just shoots the puck hard around the curve of the glass and boards, sending it ringing around the perimeter of the rink.
Yes. Think about the geometry of the 2-1-2. You have committed two forwards deep into the corner. Often, your strong side defenseman at the blue line will pinch down the wall to help seal the trap.
So that means you have three players deeply committed to one side of the ice.
Exactly. If the opposing defenseman is strong enough to rip the puck high off the glass and rim it all the way around to the far side, it bypasses all three of those players instantly.
Because the curved glass accelerates the puck, and suddenly it's rocketing out into the neutral zone, and your two deep attackers are stranded 80 feet behind the play.
It immediately generates a 3-on-2 odd man rush, going the other way. High risk, high reward.
But wait, it gets even riskier, doesn't it? The source mentions something called the full ice press.
Oh, the full ice press. This is what happens when you snap the pressure dial completely off. It is maximum chaos.
Visualizing this, all three forwards are deep hunting the puck, and both defensemen are pinching down from the blue line.
Yes.
The entire middle of the ice behind them, back toward their own goalie, is completely empty. There is zero safety net.
It is barely a system. It is a desperate, frantic decision to accept unlimited risk in exchange for keeping the puck in the offensive zone. If the opponent makes one single clean pass out of the zone, they have an uncontested breakaway from their own blue line.
You would only ever do this if you were down a goal with 40 seconds left, or your goalie is already pulled for an extra attacker.
Right? Exactly. Or, and this is a brilliant rule nuance, during a delayed penalty.
Walk me through the mechanics of the delayed penalty.
In hockey, when the referee raises their arm to signal a penalty against Team A, play does not stop immediately. Play only stops when a player from Team A gains control of the puck.
Gaining control being the key word. So if Team B passes the puck and it accidentally deflects off the shin guard of a Team A player, the whistle doesn't blow.
Precisely. A deflection or a block shot is not control. Therefore, when Team B sees the referee's arm go up, they immediately pull their goalie and send out a sixth skater.
Ah, I see.
They now have a 6-on-5 advantage. And they know the opponent cannot shoot the puck into their empty net because the moment the opponent controls the puck to shoot, the whistle blows.
It's a completely free roll. You have zero defensive responsibility.
So you run a full ice press,
yeah.
Send everyone deep, you pinch every wall, you keep the puck alive at all costs.
Incredible. Okay, so that is what it looks like when a coach wants win one, the jackpot.
Mm-hmm.
But what if the opponent is just flat out faster than you?
That happens a lot.
Right. What if you are playing a team that will easily win a foot race to the corner and trying to run a 2-1-2 just gets you burned all night?
That is the exact moment the philosophy shifts from hunting to trapping. You stop trying to win the jackpot and you start building a web. This is about securing win two, forcing a bad pass into the neutral zone.
And the most forgiving, universally utilized default for this is the 1-2-2 containment system.
Let's count it out. One forward deep. Two forwards staggered on the walls across the middle of the zone. Two defensemen high at the blue line.
Our source text provides a brilliant animal tonguing model to explain how the players inside this shape actually behave. We have the dog, the fox, and the hawk. I love this analogy. Let's break down the menagerie. What exactly does the dog do?
F1 is the dog. But crucially, in a containment system, the dog is a sheepdog, not an attack dog. The dog pressures the puck carrier, but explicitly does not commit to winning the puck.
That feels so counterintuitive for a hockey player. You are flying in at high speed, the puck is right there, and you're actively choosing not to try and poke it away.
It takes discipline. Because if you lunge for the puck and miss, the opponent cuts right past you and the entire containment web is breached at the first layer. The dog's only job is to steer.
So they use that curved approach again.
Yes. They use a curved approach to cut the ice in half, physically forcing the puck carrier to skate up one specific side of the rink. The dog stays on the inside shoulder, ensuring the puck cannot be passed back across the middle.
You are herding them into an alley. And who is waiting in the alley?
The fox. F2 sits patiently on the strong side wall, hovering right in the area where the opposing winger is waiting for an outlet pass.
Just lurking.
Exactly. Okay. The fox doesn't chase the puck carrier into the corner. The fox waits for the desperate pass that the dog is forcing the defenseman to make. The fox creates the turnover by jumping into that predictable passing lane at the last possible microsecond.
And what about the third forward?
F3 is the hawk. The hawk roams the high middle of the ice, uncommitted, reading the play from a bird's eye view. Mm. The hawk takes away the center lane, and the true genius of the 1-2-2 is how seamlessly it rotates if the opponent manages to reverse the puck.
How does that work?
If the defenseman somehow escapes the dog and passes the puck back across the ice behind their own net, the hawk instantly swoops down to the far wall to become the new fox. The old fox slides backward up into the middle to become the new hawk.
The shape survives. Only the people inside it change. It's like a net that just organically shifts side to side. It concedes the deep corner, but it builds a wall they have to pass through to get out.
It is incredibly frustrating to play against because there is simply no open ice to skate into. But if you want to see a true human net, we have to examine the 1-3-1.
The 1-3-1. Okay, one forward steering deep, then a completely flat line of three players standing across the middle of the ice, and one safety player high.
This system was weaponized brilliantly by Guy Boucher when he coached the Tampa Bay Lightning around 2011. It was so ruthlessly effective at destroying the neutral zone that it famously caused the Philadelphia Flyers to just stop playing.
Wait, literally stop playing?
Literally. The Flyers' defensemen stood perfectly still behind their own net with the puck, refusing to advance, while the Tampa Bay forwards just stood there waiting for them. The referees had to blow the whistle because the game just ceased to exist.
That is the ultimate sign of a broken meta. So who makes up that flat line of three players?
It's usually your F2 on one half wall, a highly intelligent defenseman sitting dead center, acting as the read maker, and F3 on the far half wall. As your single forechecker, F1, steers the puck to one side, that entire flat line of three players shifts laterally as a single connected unit.
How do three humans, wearing skates, moving backward, keep a perfectly flat line without colliding or leaving massive gaps for the opponent to pass through?
It requires incredible communication and visual anchoring. They use the painted lines on the ice, the hash marks, the blue line, to maintain their depth.
That takes a lot of coordination.
Huge amounts. They keep their sticks incredibly active, constantly scanning their peripheral vision to maintain exactly 20 feet of distance from the partner next to them. They deny passing lanes entirely rather than checking bodies.
But it's not foolproof, right?
No, it's a highly advanced system. Because if the opponent manages one perfectly executed chip pass over that flat line, all three of those players are eliminated instantly. You bypass the entire midfield, leaving just one solitary safety defenseman to try and stop a multiplayer rush.
High risk, in its own way. Okay, let's briefly touch on the extremes of containment. What about the 1-4?
The 1-4 is the ultimate turtle. One forward steers mildly in the offensive zone, and four skaters stand in a flat line entirely back on their own defensive blue line. It's a full retreat.
You are daring the opponent to gain speed and forcing them to dump the puck into your zone.
Yes. You only use this to protect a lead in the final 60 seconds, or if your team is so devastated by fatigue or injuries that generating offense is no longer a priority.
And then there's the hybrid, the system that bridges the gap, the left swing lock, or the 2-3.
This is a beautiful piece of hockey history. It originated in Czechoslovak hockey in the 1970s. The Czechs were trying to figure out how to combat the dominant Soviet Red Army teams who played with this incredible weaving high possession style.
Then it migrated to the NHL later.
Yeah, later on, Barry Smith and Scotty Bowman adapted the lock for the narrower North American rinks with the Detroit Red Wings in the 1990s.
How does it actually function on the ice?
Visually, it looks like an aggressive forecheck initially. You have two forwards, usually the center and the right wing, pressuring very hard deep in the offensive zone. They aren't hunting. But the left wing locks.
What does it mean, locks?
Instead of joining the attack, the left winger actively drops back to the half boards. If the center and right wing don't win the puck immediately, that left winger slides all the way back into a flat line with the two defensemen.
So you create a three-man defensive wall on the fly.
Yes. You essentially have a third defenseman if the aggressive part of the forecheck fails. You are almost never outnumbered on a counterattack. The trade-off is massive, though.
Because it demands a lot of discipline.
It demands a left winger with the positional discipline of a monk. And because you are always pulling a forward high, you sacrifice your fifth attacker in the offensive zone. You simply cannot sustain long offensive zone possession cycles as effectively.
So the mental model here for you listening, for all containment, whether it's the 1-2-2 sheepdog, the 1-3-1 human net, or the left wing lock, is that you are taking away lanes, not players. You are building walls and letting the opponent's impatience force them into a mistake. But all of this intricate forward play collapses entirely if the back end makes a bad read. Let's pivot to the blue line.
This is where championships are won and lost. The defensemen gamble. To pinch or not to pinch?
The pinch. It is the moment that makes every coach hold their breath. Let's define it physically for the listener. A pinch is when a defenseman steps down from the safety of the offensive blue line, moving aggressively along the side wall to intercept a rimmed puck or crush an opposing winger before they can catch a clearing attempt.
It is the highest stakes gamble in any forechecking system. When a defenseman pinches, they are abandoning their defensive post. The golden rule, taught universally from peewee to the pros, is this. If you can't arrive on contact, don't go.
Let's unpack the math of that. Arriving on contact means what?
It means that you, the defenseman, and the puck must arrive at the opponent's winger on the wall at the exact same fraction of a second. You have to arrive early enough to either play the puck directly with your stick or legally seal that opposing winger's body against the glass before they have a chance to look up and make a play.
And if you are late, like if you misjudge the speed of the puck zooming around the glass by half a second.
If you are late, the winger taps the puck past you. You have just taken your own math entirely out of the play. Your momentum is carrying you into the corner, and the opponent is flying down the ice with a massive numerical advantage.
So what is the safety net? How do teams survive a failed pinch?
It relies entirely on the weak side defenseman, the partner on the opposite side of the ice. Before the strong side defenseman ever commits to pinching down the wall, the weak side partner must slide into the middle of the ice, align with the center dot, and act as a pure safety valve.
So communication is everything.
Absolutely. If both defensemen pinch simultaneously, which happens when communication breaks down, a failure results in a clean multiplayer breakaway. If only one pinches and the partner holds the middle, a failure results in a 2-on-1 rush. It is still a dire situation, but a world-class goalie can survive a 2-on-1.
But the timing of the pinch is only half the battle. This is where the rulebook nuances blew my mind in the source material. Arriving on contact settles the timing, but what you are physically and legally allowed to do when you arrive depends entirely on whose ice you are standing on.
It is a legal minefield that defensemen have to navigate in milliseconds. Let's imagine a scenario.
Okay.
Pinch down the wall, the opposing winger sees you coming, and they quickly chip the puck past you into the neutral zone just a fraction of a second before you hit them. The puck is gone, but your momentum carries you into them. Are you going to the penalty box?
It depends entirely on the governing body.
Exactly. USA Hockey utilizes a lane and speed test, which is nested deep within their interference rule. If a defender maintains their established normal skating lane and is traveling at a reasonable foot speed, contact is deemed legal, even if the puck was just released. The legal obligation is actually on the attacker to go around the defender.
So you own the ice you were skating on, but you can't alter your path to hit them.
Right. If the defender stops moving their feet or actively changes their lane, veering like a heat-seeking missile specifically to hit the player who just released the puck, that is textbook interference.
Okay, contrast that with Hockey Canada.
Hockey Canada removes the subjectivity of lanes and speed entirely. They use a rigid physical distance test for a late hit. Rule 8.3 explicitly dictates that immediate contact is defined by a maximum distance of one arm length plus one stick length.
So it's measurable.
Very measurable. If the puck is further away than an arm and a stick length when your shoulder connects with the opponent, you are late. You are guilty of interference, regardless of your skating lane.
And we are not just talking about a minor penalty for a miscalculation here.
Not if the hit is violent. No major rulebook caps a late hit at a mere 2-minute minor, if it involves reckless endangerment. Hockey Canada and the IIHF mandate a major penalty and a game misconduct for late hits that recklessly endanger an opponent, even if the player gets up uninjured.
Wow. And USA Hockey.
USA Hockey ties this action to roughing, which brings major and match penalties directly into play.
And whether you are checking legally on a pinch or receiving a check, we have to talk about posture on the wall.
This is the single most important safety lesson for any player at any level. You must never take contact on the wall with your back turned to the boards, and you must never, ever duck.
The source outlines the proper mechanics perfectly. Skates must be parallel to the wall. You put your forearm and your hip flush against the glass to absorb the energy. Keep your head up, and critically, keep your chin off your chest.
If your back is turned, you cannot brace for the impact, and you invite a hit from behind. And as we discussed earlier, if your chin is tucked, your cervical spine becomes a straight column. Taking a heavy hit on a pinch for the tucked chin is how catastrophic paralysis injuries occur. Posture is non-negotiable.
So, to put myself in the skates of a defenseman, I have to calculate the velocity of a vulcanized rubber puck sliding around curved glass. I have to physically locate my defensive partner's positioning in the middle of the ice. I have to track F3's rotation to see if a forward is covering my point. I have to square my shoulders parallel to the boards. And I have to internally reference my specific league's rulebook definition of an arm and stick length, all in about 0.4 seconds.
That is why elite defensemen are paid millions of dollars. But the mental model an expert uses simplifies all of this noise. It comes down to a rapid binary checklist. Look at your partner. Are they safe in the middle? Yes. Read the puck speed. Can I arrive on contact? Yes. Commit. Once you commit, do not hesitate. Hesitation is what gets you caught in no man's land.
Okay. We have covered the shapes, the roles, and the defensive gamble, but we need to talk about context. A forecheck doesn't exist in a vacuum. How the opponent gets the puck changes the entire strategic equation.
This is the separator between good teams and great teams.
Yeah.
A good team runs a 2-1-2. A great team knows exactly when the 2-1-2 is the wrong choice. There are three distinct game states in the offensive zone.
Let's run through them. Game state one. Off a dump-in.
In a dump-in, you dictated the play. You shot the puck into the corner deliberately. Because it was a planned action, your forwards have a head start. F1 should be accelerating across the blue line the exact moment the puck leaves the stick. In this state, you dictate the clock. You hunt aggressively.
Game state two is entirely different, off a turnover.
Let's say your team has the puck. You are trying to make a pass in the offensive zone, and the opponent intercepts it. You are now instantly out of position. Uh-huh. You are in recovery mode, not hunting mode. The visceral human instinct for every player on the ice is to swarm the puck and try to win it back immediately.
It's just a panic response. Fix the mistake.
And it is a tactical disaster. If everyone chases a turnover, you leave massive swaths of the ice undefended. Instead, the protocol is this. The single closest player to the turnover, regardless of their position, pressures the puck carrier immediately. Their job is not to win the puck. Their job is to buy exactly 2 seconds of time.
And everyone else.
While they harass the carrier Every other player on your team completely ignores the puck and sprints back to find their specific layer in the defensive shape. And defensemen, you never, ever pinch off a turnover. You retreat.
And game state three is the control setup. This is when the opponent has the puck stopped dead behind their own net. Their heads are up. Their forwards are weaving in the neutral zone, building speed, and they are preparing a coordinated breakout.
A forechecking unit that only knows how to blindly chase a dump in will be completely paralyzed by a control setup. You cannot hunt a stationary target that sees you coming.
So what's the move?
The coach has to make a macro decision here. Do you trap? Meaning, do you pull all five of your players back into the neutral zone and force them to skate through a maze? Do you swing? Meaning your forwards skate deep into the zone, but then turn and match the forward speed of the opponent's breakout, staying right with them? Or do you flush?
Flushing, meaning you send F1 and F2 screaming behind the net to physically force the defenseman to start moving before their forwards are ready.
Yes, you force premature action. It is a brilliant tactical chess match.
But speaking of behind the net, here is where the physical environment itself becomes the most fascinating character in our story. The paint on the ice literally dictates the physical engine of modern hockey. We have to talk about the trapezoid.
The trapezoid is the invisible architect of the modern NHL. For those who aren't familiar, the trapezoid consists of painted red lines behind the goal line. They start 8 feet outward from each goalpost and widen to 11 feet at the end boards, creating a span of 28 feet. In leagues that utilize this rule, the goaltender is legally permitted to play the puck only inside these painted lines.
Okay, so it restricts the goalie. But why does that matter so much to a forechecker? Let's imagine a world without it.
Before the trapezoid was introduced, following the 2004-2005 NHL lockout, goalies like Martin Brodeur were incredibly adept at handling the puck. If there is no trapezoid, an elite puck-handling goalie acts as a third defenseman.
So you execute a perfect dump-in, sending the puck hard into the corner. Your F1 is flying in at top speed, ready to angle.
And the goaltender casually skates out into the corner, stops the puck perfectly flat, looks up, and zips a perfect outlet pass to their center at the blue line. And because it's illegal to body check a goaltender, your F1 has to just slam on the brakes and watch it happen. The forecheck is instantly neutralized. The dump-and-chase strategy dies.
But with the trapezoid?
With the trapezoid, the corners of the rink become restricted soft areas. The goalie is legally forbidden to touch the puck there. If they do, it's a penalty.
Ah, so the opposing defenseman has to go into the corner to get it. They have no choice. They have to turn their back to the play, face the glass, and try to dig the puck off the wall while a 200-pound F1 is breathing down their neck.
Exactly. That single-painted geometric shape manufactured the entire modern engine of forechecking. It guarantees that corner retrievals will be high-pressure, physical battles between skaters. The tactical application is clear. You always dump the puck hard into the corners. You never dump it softly down the middle directly behind the net, because that is inside the trapezoid where the goalie is waiting to trap it. You make the defenseman turn their back.
But the source material notes that this isn't a universal law of hockey physics. If you are playing in a league without a trapezoid, or, interestingly, in leagues in England and Wales where the enforcement of the trapezoid is currently unsettled and frequently suspended, the entire dump-and-chase meta loses its value.
In those leagues, you have to adapt your entire philosophy. You cannot rely on corner battles. You must attempt to carry the puck over the blue line with possession. Or, if you do dump it, your F1 doesn't race to the corner to hit the defenseman. F1 races to intercept the outlet pass that the goalie is inevitably going to make. You have to play the rules of the ice you are standing on.
That is just brilliant. A splash of red paint dictates billions of dollars of tactical coaching. Okay, we have reached the final stage. Masterclass synthesis, reading, reacting, and the ultimate debate. We know how to run these systems, we know the rules, but how do we break them? If I am a defenseman and I just retrieved a puck in the corner, how do I read the forecheck bearing down on me?
You have roughly 1 second to scan the ice and process the geometry. First, count the forwards deep below the face-off circles. If you look up and see two opposing jerseys deeply committed in your zone, you are facing an aggressive 2-on-2 or a left-wing lock. You must expect immediate, heavy, physical contact. Move the puck instantly. Do not hold it.
And if there is only one forward deep?
Then you are facing a containment system, a 1-2-2 or a 1-3-1. You will have a moment of space initially, but do not be fooled. You are skating directly into a structured wall.
Step two, watch the route of F1.
This tells you their intent. If F1 is coming at you in a completely straight line, at top speed, they are hunting the puck. They are fully committed. Because they are in a straight line, you can easily beat them by absorbing the pressure and slipping a quick reverse pass to your defensive partner behind the net. F1 won't be able to stop and change direction.
But if F1 is taking that curved approach we talked about...
If they are curving and slightly moderating their speed, they are the dog. They are steering you. They want you to skate up the wall. If you skate up the wall, you are walking straight into the fox's trap. You must change the side of the ice before you commit to the wall.
And step 3. Watch their far side defenseman. If that defenseman is on their toes leaning over the blue line, they are preparing to pinch. A hard rim around the glass past them is your best escape route. If they are sagging back, retreating toward the red line, they are conceding the zone, and you have time to make a short, controlled breakout pass.
You can also read their rotational shape. If you pass D to D and a new F1 instantly attacks your partner, you are facing a rotating aggressive system. If you pass D to D and their entire formation just slides laterally while keeping its distance, it is a containment web. You can pass D to D all day long as a free reset until you find a seam.
Okay, so countering an aggressive system means quick puck movement, rimming past the pinch, and using reverse passes against a charging F1. Countering a containment system requires extreme patience, lateral resets to force their wall to shift, and then chipping the puck into empty space past their flat line so your forwards can win a foot race. You never, ever try to stick handle your way through three players standing in a flat line.
Which brings us to the ultimate perennial coaching debate. Imagine you are facing an elite, highly skilled puck-moving defenseman, a true generational talent. Do you pressure them or do you contain them?
This is the nightmare scenario for a coach. If you pressure them, you deny them the oxygen they need, you force them to hurry, hoping they bobble the puck.
But the devastating counterargument is that aggressive pressure gives an elite puck mover exactly what they dream of, a deeply committed forechecker who takes themselves out of the play and vast, open expanses of ice behind them. If they use one elite edgework maneuver to dodge your F1, they will instantly exploit that massive space and completely shred your defensive structure.
So what is the answer? How does a professional coach actually make that decision on a Tuesday night in November?
The secret tiebreaker actually has very little to do with the elite opponent. The decision is based entirely on your team. It comes down to your roster's fitness, leg exhaustion, and foot speed.
Knowing your own limitations.
Exactly. Aggressive pressure only beats a highly skilled passer if your F1 can actually arrive physically before the pass is made. If your players are at the end of a long shift, or if your roster simply lacks the foot speed to close that gap instantly, running a 2-1-2 is suicide. Containment is not cowardly. It is mathematically the only viable option. You contain because a missed pressure against an elite player is a guaranteed high-danger scoring chance against you.
You play the hand you are dealt, not the hand you wish you had. I love that.
And that synthesis really brings this entire masterclass together. We watch hockey and see a physical, brutal battle. But underneath the surface, forechecking is an intricate mental chess match, calculated and executed at 20 miles per hour.
Which brings us to the final buzzer. We promised you, the listener, that by the end of this deep dive, you would see the game differently. So we are going to put you right down on the ice for one final 30-second shift. Let's walk through it real time and watch all 10 core principles we've discussed fire in sequence.
The puck drops. Your team dumps it deep into the corner. You remember principle 1, exploit the trapezoid. You dumped it into the corner intentionally because the goalie cannot legally touch it there, forcing the defenseman to turn their back.
Your closest forward flies in. Principle 2. Roles, not positions. It doesn't matter that it's the center. They are first, so they are F1. F1 executes principle 3, angling over hitting. They use a curved approach, taking away the middle, steering the defenseman up the wall, and crucially, principle 4, safety. F1 arrives under control and refuses to hit the defenseman squarely in the numbers while they face the glass.
The defenseman is forced up the wall. Your F2 is waiting. This is principle 5. Know your shapes. You are running a 2-1-2, so F2 isn't chasing the puck. F2 is hunting the first passing option on the half wall.
But the defenseman makes a miracle cross-ice pass. F1 is beaten. Principle 6 kicks in. Rotate, don't chase. F1 drops into the high support role to catch their breath. And F3 instantly becomes the new F1 on the far side.
But suddenly, there's a turnover. Your team fumbles the puck. Principle 7. Situational awareness. Off a turnover, you do not hunt. One player pressures to buy time, and everyone else immediately retreats to recover the defensive shape.
You fall back into a 1-2-2. The opponent tries to break out. They pass it up the wall. Your defenseman at the blue line sees it coming. Principle 8, the defenseman's gamble. Your defenseman calculates the puck speed, sees their partner safely in the middle, realizes they can arrive on contact, and pinches hard, sealing the winger against the glass with perfect posture.
The puck pops loose into the neutral zone. The opponent regroups and tries to counter a 1-3-1 trap. You know Principle 9. Read the opposition. You see, they're trying to pass through a flat wall.
And Principle 10. Beating a trap requires chips and foot races. The opponent stubbornly tries to stick handle through three of your players. They lose the puck. You recover it, transition forward, and the cycle begins all over again.
That is the mental framework of an elite system. Those 10 principles are happening on every single shift, hidden in plain sight.
You now have the exact tools to read the ice like a professional scout. So, to circle all the way back to the beginning, we said watching hockey looks like a high-speed car crash. But now you see the fluid geometry, you see the dog steering the sheep, you see the F3 rotating high to cover the pinching defenseman, you see the mathematical balance of the pressure and risk dial. But I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over the next time you are at the rink.
We established that the geometry of the rink dictates the tactics.
Exactly. The trapezoid was literally invented by the league to generate more offense by restricting the goalie, essentially forcing defensemen into the corners where forecheckers can hunt them down. It created the modern game. But what happens if the rules of the geometry change? If leagues decide to remove that red paint entirely tomorrow, if world-class puck-handling goalies are suddenly allowed to roam free in the corners again to act as a third defenseman, does the aggressive dump-and-chase forecheck go extinct overnight? Are we looking at a future where the legendary 2-1-2 system is rendered completely obsolete by a single rule change? Next time you watch a game, don't just watch the puck. Watch the corners. See who goes there. See how they arrive. And ask yourself how a single painted line is dictating the entire physical engine of the sport. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.